Welcome back, Science Decoders. I hope you guys enjoyed listening to our first season slate of episodes. This season, hopefully, we're going to have just as many and more great, interesting scientists with awesome personalities and very fun stories that are going to be able to enlighten us into the current research that they're conducting and how it's going to help us, hopefully, and help out humanity along the way. Before we get this season kicked off, I just wanted to say a few words. Firstly, I just want to thank everybody at SciWorthy and the Science Decoded team for helping me put together this podcast. It's been an incredible journey. It's been a really great time. And everything we do here at Science Decoded and SciWorthy is almost completely volunteer-based. And with that being said, one of our lovely volunteers, Jocelyn, has decided to step down for this next semester. She returns to focus on school and family. So until then, you guys are just going to get to hear me talking to either my dog or potentially other scientists. It depends on how much wisdom you feel like Sadie has in the moment. Anyway, with recent current events and scientific news, I'm sure you guys have all heard about the Perseverance rover. Well, Perseverance, or Percy as it's coined, is a rover designed to go down to Mars and look for life. It's going to return samples to Earth, at which point our scientists are going to begin looking through the soil and the dirt and the water and whatever else it brings, and try and find either evidence of previous life, such as chemicals, fossils, and special compositions, or life itself. But one thing that it's doing that is very important to keep in mind is that it's looking for life as we know it. So that means life as we've defined it here today. Life is what we see when we look out our window and see trees, or life when we look around and see plants. For those of you who are interested in this idea, this topic of how did life arrive on Earth? How did life come up? And maybe what really, really old forms of life looked like, you might be interested in the topic of prebiotic chemistry. Prebiotic chemistry really is just the subject that studies how nature came about in its random, potentially uninspired way. And for many, that means investigating molecules and very complex systems designed by other models and computers and people making informed decisions about what early Earth might have looked like in order for us to predict important reactions and important pathways that brought together all the molecules needed for biology and life to start. Now, many people will ask me this question, since it is my specialty, you know, Justin, why is prebiotic chemistry important? How do I benefit from it? How does my family benefit from it? How does the United States benefit from it? Well, typically, I always like to pull out two answers. And with pulling out these two answers, I also want to add a caveat that there are other counter arguments and other thoughts on the matter as well, which I won't be addressing here. However, if you want to communicate those, feel free to write in. We'd love to talk about them. We'd love to address them, and we'd love to share them. You know, a lot of these things in science, we're just providing evidence for. And right now, I'm providing evidence for what I have. But if you have a position in which you believe you have evidence, and I misjustly represented that, we would love for you to write in and let me know. So first of all, I think looking for life on another planet or investigating the origin of life is important because that pathway of discovery leads to great and new scientific innovation that ends up helping humanity. A lot of the work that we do in science, especially in prebiotic chemistry, is requiring more and more advanced technology and delicate, intricate, and very calibrated methods, which work on very, very small scales and very, very large scales. And as we begin to do this more efficiently and more effectively, so that we can do science more efficiently and more effectively, this technology is going to get leaked into the public sphere in a very good and intentional fashion that's going to lead to great developments that are going to enhance our relationship and our communication with technology. There are also some in particular philosophical circles believe that because science is out there and because we have the ability to, we should be allowed to explore it. It's like a giant playground. Because we have the ability to go to space, we're doing so in order to further humanity and in order to further ourselves, hopefully trying to make the Earth a better place while we do it. There are some counter arguments on why the search for life and the search for the origin of life are somewhat pointless. And that kind of comes from two different camps. The first of which is, you know, someone can choose to define life in a certain way that you're not thinking of the way life is defined. In scientific literature, there are 80-some definitions of life and how we classify life. The most standard are, is it moving? Can it reproduce? Does it have a metabolism? And I think there's two others. And that just shows you how complex the definition of life really is this is my field of study, and there are some very significant and serious differences between how different fields define a system as living. There are also some who believe that life has come about supernaturally, in which case, there is no way that science could prove or disprove that statement. Science can only provide evidence for one working theory or one belief, but science cannot provide evidence in something that is supernatural, since science only studies the natural, in which case, there will be no evidence, or no evidence of the true way that life came about, if it did come about supernaturally. However, myself, much like many, find the truth somewhere in the middle, oftentimes requiring a combination of both faith and scientific truth to bring about a more holistic picture about how life started on Earth, where life might be on other planets, and if we truly are alone in the universe. And when we get back, we'll be talking to Lena Vincent at the University of Wisconsin about her recent discovery in prebiotic chemistry. Well, welcome back, Science Decoders. Today I have with me Lena Vincent. She's a PhDC at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And we're talking about her research today that she's done at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. So Lena, why don't you first tell us, you know, what kind of questions or questions were you aiming to ask that led you to establishing this project?
Yeah, so I've been interested in many different things over the course of my academic career. And a few years before I started my PhD, I started to be interested in somewhat more existential questions than I'd been asking in the past. Things like, you know, why is life the way it is? When did life get started? Does life exist on other worlds? And I think those are the very questions that are now guiding my PhD research. And when I realized that you could make a scientific career out of asking those questions as a scientist, I never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like such an exciting field and such a wonderful thing to think about. And I think many of our listeners, including myself, have had very similar thoughts when staring up at the stars at night. What sort of specific questions about chemistry were you asking that maybe led to how you decided to form your experiments or led to the way that you constructed your paper?
Yeah, so we think that there are tangible differences between the chemistry of life and the chemistry of non-living things, but we're not exactly sure how those differences work and where they come from and how they started. So that's the specific question that we're trying to ask, is how do you get living chemistry from non-living chemistry? And in our research group, we're focusing on a handful of processes that we think are key in distinguishing these two. And the two processes we're interested in particular is how does chemistry sustain itself, right? How does the particular chemical reaction persist in time, right? We tend to think of chemical reactions as things that happen once, and when they've happened, they're over, right? But how do you get them to sustain themselves? And then the other process is the building of complexity. How do you get more complexity in your chemistry? And in biology, we know that happens through evolution. So the specific question that we're asking that's guiding the experiments that I've been doing and including this paper is, how do the processes characteristic of life, including self-propagation and evolution, take hold in chemical systems? And what does that look like?
Is there any difference between chemical evolution and then what we consider as biological evolution? Is there any difference between those two?
It depends who you ask. So there are some thinkers out there who think that there can be ways to unify what we term chemical evolution and biological evolution. In practice, there do seem to be differences, right? The way that biological systems execute evolution is through a very defined set of processes with very specific kinds of molecules that can encode information and pass it on, right? And non-living chemical systems don't necessarily have that, right? So the process of evolution, the net effect might be similar, right? You generate complexity over time. There's some degree of heritability and memory, but how that's executed might look different. And there are different ideas for how you could unify the different ways in which chemical systems and biological systems do that. In our research group, we tend to think of, we're trying to unify chemical evolution and biological evolution by kind of reimagining what evolution means and what it can look like in chemical systems. But in general, it depends on who you ask and what their specific definition of evolution is. But in my view, yes, in some ways, yes.
Okay, cool. So what kind of conclusions was your team able to draw from the experiments and the data that resulted?
Yeah, so like I said, our big overlying question is how do you get the processes of life manifested in chemical systems? And the two processes, again, were self-propagation and evolution. And our goal in this paper and in general as a lab is to test a procedure or an approach that we've been developing called chemical ecosystem selection to try to study these behaviors in chemical systems. Because it turns out that's not done and that's not easy to do in chemistry. And so our purpose with this paper was to kind of pilot or test out this new approach and show an example of the cool kind of chemistry you can get as a result. And so we did find a set of conditions in our laboratory that we think were consistent with the appearance of at least some of the characteristics of life, like the ability to sustain growth in these conditions. And so that's what we reported on in that paper, as we showed data that seem to be consistent with the appearance of this behavior. And the chemical term, by the way, is autocatalysis. I tend to just refer to it as self-propagation, but the way that these chemical systems would be executing self-propagation would be through this autocatalytic process. And so our conclusion is that this approach that we've developed seems to yield patterns that are consistent with the emergence of autocatalysis, although we're doing a lot more work to verify that now. But that's our main conclusion from that paper.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So you mentioned that you guys used, the molecular or the multiple catalytic systems? Was that what mm-hmm. you said?
Yeah.
So can you explain to our listeners a little bit more about what those autocatalytic systems are and what that really means?
Yeah, absolutely. So autocatalysis is a really interesting behavior that a set of chemical reactions can do. And basically, it goes like this. You have a chemical. It can be any kind of garden variety chemical you have, and we'll label it A. And A can facilitate or trigger another reaction that makes another molecule called B. B can help make another molecule, C, but then the key step is that C can make A, that first molecule again. So you kind of have this cycle of cooperating chemicals that facilitate each other's formation, right? Now, a cell is just a really complex one of those autocatalytic cycles. Instead of having ABC, you have millions and millions of different molecule types creating this kind of web or network of interacting reactions. So autocatalysis is a mechanism, is a plausible stepping stone to that complexity, that complex network. Except in the realm of our experiments, we're working with much simpler systems. And we think that this is a very plausible way by which that complexity could have started is through those very simple chemical networks of A, Bs, and Cs helping each other out that eventually got more and more complex over time. So that's the basis behind autocatalysis and why we think it might have played a key role at the origin of life.
Is there any reason to believe or think that the simplicity of your systems might have an effect on the outcome? Would you like to see future research done with more complex systems that potentially would you think holds up your results that you saw from this study?
Certainly. And that is a logical next step from whatever we end up finding in our results is to just add more and more complexity until we start to approach what we see in biological systems. But there's a bit of a trade-off between how complex we can aim for our systems to be and how tractable they are experimentally, so how we can make sense of the results. So there's always kind of a balance there. But that's why we start simple, is so we can get an understanding of what's going on, get a sense of what we might see if we make the system more complex. That way, when we go for the more complex experiments, we have a bit of a framework to work from. So yeah, absolutely. I think that it will be very meaningful and very helpful to add more complexity. And there are different ways to do that, right? We could add more chemicals, or we could make the conditions a little bit messier, start playing around with the temperature. So we have easy ways to add complexity, but we're going to incrementally add it as we learn more about the systems we're working with.
Oh, okay. Awesome. Yeah, I would imagine it would be hard to run an experiment of like 1,000 round bottoms in this sort of situation and then look at all the slurry mixtures and figure out all the chemicals over 1,000 trials. Like, it's hard enough to do 10.
Definitely. And that is a big thing that we are working on in our lab, because the entire approach that we're taking rests on our ability to screen a large number of conditions with lots of different replicates. And so when we started these experiments, we knew that this would be an effort that went way beyond our lab. So actually, one of our major goals has been to try to inspire other research groups to use similar approaches so that we can kind of crowdsource this scanning of the chemical parameter space. And then in tandem with that, we're also working with ways to automate the approach. So right now, it means going into the lab, doing a lot of things manually. But if we could get robots to do it, that would make our lives much easier. So yeah, so the scaling problem is definitely one that we're very interested in resolving somehow.
Now, one comment we typically hear, especially when some of our listeners talk about prebiotic chemistry, and they bring into question the working models that we as prebiotic chemists use when going on to do these sorts of experiments, especially with, what you guys did, where it's kind of Miller-Urey-like, in the sense you guys have this slurry that matches a predictive model of what early Earth looks like. How assured are you in those models, and where does that assurance come from?
That's a great question. And to answer it simply, we don't have any assurance in those models, right? They're just models. And these are particularly challenging ones to place any uncertainty in, because we're trying to reconstruct things we've never actually seen before. So we're trying to emulate a point in time we can't realistically get back to. Scientists in the field call this the historical problem of trying to reconstruct the origin of life. Is there some parts of the history we will never be able to access, and will never therefore be sure if we've matched it in some way? And the way we're getting around that is by not caring. So we're not concerning ourselves necessarily with whether the conditions that we have in our flasks are representative of early Earth. We just want to know whether or not they work. And we're hoping that by doing that over and over again with different conditions, we can say, this seems to be a commonality between them. It does seem like this particular component that we've added is important. And try to extract information from there rather than try to recreate a certain environment. So by screening lots of different environments and looking at the patterns there, that's what we're going to try to get our certainty in, rather than trying to recreate a historical environment that we just will simply know for sure existed or not. So, yeah.
How was your paper received by your peers at large? What was some of the feedback you guys received?
I think overall the response has been really, really great. In the origin of life field, there's been this push towards trying to understand less the origins of particular features of life. So, where did genetics come from? Where did ATP come from? So specific structures that seem to be important today. And focus more on the processes, the net outcomes of life, right? So evolution, self-propagation. But until recently, there hasn't been very tangible ways of doing that in the laboratory. So most of the work trying to study these processes in their onset in plausible prebiotic settings has mostly been theoretical, computational in nature. We are trying to create actual experimental protocols you can go in the lab and do. I think that was a very welcome thing. So, and I think regardless of whether people agree with the framework that we're operating under, if they have the same hypothesis about what's necessary and what came first, I think that there's this appreciation for this new type of approach. And we're not alone, right? There are other approaches that are similar in this, but we're just starting to see them come up. And I think that the response is really great. And I think there's this recognition that, great, finally, we're actually making some headway in this department of trying to study life as a system, as a process, rather than a collection of specific things.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, when I see this research, I see something that's very interdisciplinary, very crosses over a lot of different fields of science, involves a lot of different scientists and a lot of different techniques. What was kind of the weirdest field of science or the least thought of field of science that you borrowed information from to kind of help your working model or compare to draw conclusions from?
I think there are two ways to answer that question. They're the weirdest for me, given my background, and then the weirdest in terms of the field itself. Now, with respect to the field itself of origin of life, I think that actually bringing in evolutionary biology is kind of weird because the field is dominated mostly by planetary science, geology, chemistry, of course. Those are kind of the dominant ways of tackling the problem of the origin of life, and it's surprising that evolutionary biology doesn't feature as much because ultimately that's what we're after, right? We're looking for the onset of evolution. But it didn't seem like that really informed a lot of the different approaches that were being taken. And surprisingly, there are a lot of misconceptions about how evolution works in the origin of life field. So with respect to the field itself, I think the evolutionary biology aspect is definitely like the most novel or quirky. For me, I'm a biologist by training, so I'm totally comfortable in that realm. But I think probably the weirdest is physical chemistry, you know, trying to wrap my head around that.
And oh, heck yeah.
Trying to use, you know, different thermodynamic calculations and studying kinetics and looking at nonlinear reaction systems. That for me feels the most exotic, although with respect to the field, that's kind of where it's been operating mostly. So yeah, highly interdisciplinary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for any of our listeners that might be taking thermo or in physical chemistry right now, I think they can agree with you that it's definitely a different way to think. That's for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And as a biologist, I haven't been, you know, thinking about entropy and things like that. It's a totally new realm for me, and I'm loving it.
So what sort of other science have you seen that's branched off of what you guys have done here?
So I don't know that I've seen anything branch off per se, but there are definitely some highly complementary approaches that have been taken around the same time, which is great because it you know, the more angles we can tackle this question from using similar approaches, I think the more progress we'll make. So one that comes to mind is a really promising approach used by Leroy Cronin's group at the University of Glasgow. So they're a big chemistry lab. They do a lot of things from like digitizing chemistry and machine learning. The other problem they're interested in, obviously, is the origin of life. And so they've developed a somewhat similar approach that's based on trying to coax out the behaviors of living systems in chemical instantiations. But the thing they're looking for more than evidence of evolution and evidence of the processes of life taking hold is complexity. So they're looking to the complexity of the resulting reactions as an indicator of whether or not something lifelike has happened. And they've defined kind of this threshold of complexity beyond which you can reasonably assert that the process has to be lifelike in some way. So there's no other way to generate that level of complexity in the absence of a lifelike process. And so the principle is the same, trying to look at these self-sustaining reaction networks of chemical reactions. But instead of looking at specific processes, they're looking at signatures of complexity and how it might increase over time. So very complementary, inspired by different hypotheses about what makes living systems special and what kinds of conditions are necessary, but super complementary. And there are other examples as well. But yeah, I'll be curious to see how those branch out and create even more different threads to pull on and try to get finally at this question of how do you get living chemistry from non-living stuff.
Yeah, and that's a big question, right? And some people say it can't be done, but it's, you know, we'll be darned if we don't do it. And we got to at least give it our best shot, right? So going back to the multi-catalytic systems that you guys were using to investigate origin of life, what did a typical day in the lab look like while you were working on this project? You know, what kind of instruments did you interface with? What kind of chemicals did you interface with? What kind of machines did you use?
Yeah, so I think it's kind of surprising when you think about it, because the science that we're doing, the questions that we're trying to answer are so big and grand that it can seem like whatever we're doing is probably super intimidating and sophisticated. But actually, everything we do is pretty simple. You know, typical day is trying to make the solutions of chemicals that we're going to use. So weighing out chemicals, working at a scale, making precise measurements, adding them, dissolving them to water. Then some of the funner stuff we do is grind up minerals. So just taking a hammer to minerals, grinding them up. Sometimes, depending on the mineral, we have to use heavy duty machinery. At our geoscience department, wear masks, you know.
Sounds like a great way to get frustration out.
Exactly. Yeah. So just let's go crush some rocks. That's a thing we do a lot. And then probably my favorite thing is the analytical side. So, you know, how do you actually look for evidence of lifelike chemistry? And for that, we use a whole bunch of cool instruments. We use X-ray diffractometers, which are basically just big X-ray guns that you can shoot X-rays with. And based on what bounces back from those X-rays, you can get information about what's in there and how pure a sample is. Electron microscopy, which is a way to get really high resolution images of the samples that we have. And then a whole bunch of other chemical assays where things change color and we look at the way things behave with light. So that is the funnest part, I think, the least repetitive part of our experiments. But in reality, most of it is very mundane. It's just getting in there, weighing chemicals, mixing them together, and then waiting. That's a big part of it. That's a big part of a day in a lab, is waiting around for stuff to be done. So, yeah, but it's really fun.
That and cleaning, right?
In cleaning, yeah. Yes, that's a great point. Yeah, a lot of our results hinge on keeping things clean and not contaminating them with actual life so that we can actually get at the things that we're interested in. So, yeah, cleaning, sterilizing, that is also a huge part of our daily activities.
Now, when you guys are researching these multi-catalytic systems, obviously, as you indicated earlier, complexity is somewhat important, but also a difficult thing to overcome when you're looking for maybe precursors to life. But does that rule out that the possibility that maybe on another planet, some of these complex molecules are actually going on to form organisms or organized structure that we would consider life?
Yeah, and I think your question gets to another major hurdle in, you know, trying to understand life as a general phenomenon, maybe something that exists on other worlds, is this question of what do you need, right? What is necessary for living chemistry to be possible? And we just don't know. So at this point, I would say anything's possible. but that's kind of the beauty of the kind of approach that we're trying to favor in our laboratory, one that focuses on processes, right? So looking at the net outcome, what is the behavior of the chemical reactions as a whole, as a system, rather than depending on specific kinds of molecules of varying complexity, so that, you know, we can start to imagine what living systems might look like in the absence of that complexity, or even more complexity, or different kinds of complexity. There's no definitive answer to your question right now. And we're hoping that approaches like this will help us get at that question and constrain what is it that's necessary to get us from that transition of non-life to life.
Yeah. And I think that's a pretty, like we talk about, big transition as well, you know, not just philosophically or fundamentally, but scientifically. That is a big transition, especially when we still have debates about how to define life and what is life and what makes life unique and what the chances are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think in the literature alone, there's something like 80 different circulating definitions of life. So it's very hard to aim at not only a moving target, but a target we don't even really know how to define. So it's a big challenge, but it's very exciting, and it is a huge question. And it's also just very tantalizing to think about that transition, in the sense that it could have happened very, very gradually. And so these very simplified systems that we're studying, the fact that they could represent a plausible stage in life's early evolution and history, it's so crazy to think about that you could get all of this from something that, you know, would be undetectable almost, or unrecognizable in its earliest stages. So yeah, it's mind blowing.
So to bring in a little bit of current news or current events here, The Perseverance rover, you know, that's a really big deal. What kind of thoughts and feelings do you have about that, going to Mars and looking for signs of previous life or possibly abiotic life as well?
It's so exciting. I can't believe that it's happening, that we're going to get to watch it live. It's so, so exciting. And I think, you know, all these astrobiological missions, you know, I mean, ones that are designed to try to search for evidence of past life, but maybe even present life, are so exciting. And it's crazy to think about what they might find. But I'm looking at the rover and I'm imagining future missions, because what Percy is ultimately going to be doing on Mars is looking for signs of life as we know it, right? And that's a logical place to start. Life as we know it is what we know. It's what we know how to detect, even though we're still having trouble doing that in some cases. But trying to expand beyond that and imagine signatures of life as we might not know it is extremely difficult to do. But that's the question I'm ultimately interested in, and I think is going to be the key to finding life. So I'm super excited to see what Percy finds and how we can build on that knowledge to try to expand beyond the specifics of life as we know it and how we could go about detecting it. So very looking forward to its landing and future missions, both to Mars and to other worlds as well.
So how do you think the greater public benefits from this type of research or these types of discoveries?
Oh, I think in a lot of ways. I think, you know, if I think to from my personal experience as someone who's interested in these questions, I think that the origin of life is such an intellectually interesting question from so many different angles, right? Both scientifically and personally. This is something we just ask ourselves as human beings. We don't have to be scientists to be curious about this, obviously. And so I think that, you know, the fact that this is a pure intellectual exercise, right? Wanting to know about our origins, wanting to know about why life is the way it is, and making progress in that area, I think is beneficial to everyone just because it helps us satisfy that curiosity. And I think related to that, because you can take such an existential question and actually do science with it, I'm hoping that more people will be drawn to science because of that interest, and the recognition that you can turn this interest into a viable scientific career. So I think that it's a great way to generate new scientists. And, you know, on the indirect side, the harder to predict side, I think there will be other benefits as well. That's kind of the beauty of basic science. You never know how it's going to apply. You never know what it's going to produce in terms of beneficial technologies. And so I think it's great. Come in for the basic science and the intellectual exercise. Stick around for the potential benefits. It's hard to predict now.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners, you know, about your research, about what you like, about who you are, and, you know, maybe why you even came on the podcast?
Yeah. I mean, I consider myself an aspiring jack of all trades when it comes to science. And that's partially what drew me to this particular question, is just how interdisciplinary it is and the opportunity to pull from lots of different areas of science. And also not just the hard sciences, by the way, the humanities factor a huge amount into this too. There's such a rich history and philosophical discourse about this that it's just such a cool opportunity to just be at the frontier of something and use all the kinds of thinking you can possibly use to try to make some progress. So, I think of myself as someone who wants to really lean in on that and grow as an interdisciplinarian. And also I love to talk about it. I love to share my passion for this research and hopefully inspire others to do it too. So, that's part of the reason I came on this podcast today, to hopefully, inspire others to consider turning this very existential personal question into, something they can do as a scientist.
Nice. Well, have you defended yet?
No, but I realized that I will be defending in about 14 months. So,
all right, there you go.
Getting there, very close.
In 14 months, so what? That's April of 2022?
Yeah, April, May 2022.
Science Decoded listeners, keep her in your thoughts and prayers. But still, congrats. Thank you for your time, you know, and we really appreciate all that you've had to say, and we'll keep you in the loop. And hopefully you'll be able to hear yourself on YouTube here pretty soon.
Awesome. Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, of course. Thanks so much.
Hi again, it's your editor, Gina. I just want to thank our host, Justin Dingman, and our guest, Lena Vincent, as well as our awesome behind-the-scenes team members. We also want to thank our Patreon supporter of the month, Dr. Afshin Khan. Sciworthy's logo was created by Tammy Whitsons, and our theme song was composed and recorded by Graham Albright. Science Decoded is part of the 501c3 nonprofit Blue Marble Space. You can learn more about us at sciworthy.com and at bluemarblespace.org.